Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I welcome you all to the program that, appropriately enough, is called the Michael Cutler Hour. Those of you who are familiar with me and the program know that I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. These days, that agency is referred to as ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and it is a subdivision of an umbrella agency known as DHS, an agency the government calls the Department of Homeland Security. I, unfortunately, have a more honest appraisal of it, and I call it the Department of Homeland Surrender. I'm not going to get too much into my career and background. Rather than take up time with that, I would ask that you go to my website, michaelcutler.net. Of course, my last name is C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. Also, you should know, I'm a senior fellow with a terrific organization based in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. That organization is called CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. I've been with them for a number of years. Recently, not too many months ago, or maybe more months ago than I wish it was, I was actually out there visiting with the terrific folks who work for CAPS. They showed me a fabulous time. They're dedicated to the mission, worthy of your support, and I'm very proud to be associated with them. And they often publish not only the articles that I write, but that other folks write about the impact of the failures of our government to control, among other things, our borders and enforce our immigration laws in a meaningful way that not only seeks the two goals of protecting American lives and protecting American jobs, but also honor the Americans who came here from other countries, went through the system legally, and then became part of the tapestry of this great nation from the four corners of the planet. Time and again, I have focused this program on the failings of our government, especially where border security and especially where the enforcement and administration of the immigration laws are concerned. Unfortunately, these are issues that the media all too often glosses over or doesn't adequately address. It's a real problem. The Founding Fathers understood the need for effective journalism. That's why the First Amendment talks about not only freedom of speech and freedom of press and freedom of religion, but about the right to seek redress of grievances and the right to peaceably assemble. And those are the two components, those last two, that most people seem to forget. Certainly, the reason for becoming an educated citizen could be multi-dimensional, but from the perspective of government, it's about being the best citizens that we can be. And there is no way on earth that we can be good citizens if we are not aware of the issues, if we have no understanding of what's really going on and what should be done and is not being done and so forth. It's about being intelligent, educated citizens. And the right to peaceably assemble is about the right to engage in discourse, debate, discussion, so that hopefully we can ultimately, as Americans, arrive at a consensus. It's not about my way or the highway, but about having an honest discussion, a discussion that increasingly has become more difficult as more and more people and corporations and entities profit through the exploitation of those foreign workers who come to America. And often we hear the accusations, well, if you want the border secure, you probably don't like Mexicans. It's a ridiculous argument. It's kind of like saying that during that dark era of slavery in America, that if you didn't want to own a slave, you didn't like black people. The problem is, in this era of political correctness, not many people have the moral fiber, the guts, the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to stand up and call out those who accuse us. But if you're familiar with my style, I have no problem calling it the way it is. So that's the reason for my program. Most of my guests who join me on this show have information to give you that you're probably not going to hear anyplace else. And today I have a very interesting guest, an old friend, Jerry Casale, who will be joining me in a second. But Jerry and I go back to the days when I first became an immigration inspector at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York City. It's hard for me to believe it, but I started working for the old INS back in October of 1971. I'm starting to feel like I belong to the Dinosaur Brigade. Jerry and I were inspectors together. I was detailed for a year to the unit that did the marriage interviews that you see on radio, or the, see, on radio, very good, that you see in the movies, on films, and on TV programs, where a guy sitting behind a desk, a bureaucrat, asks the married couple who have been separated, so we have the spouse and who's the citizen and the spouse who's the alien, separated, they're asked questions to see if their answers coincide so that the adjudicator can determine whether or not they're truly living together as husband and wife, or if they entered into a business deal to be able to provide the alien with a green card, and presumably the American or lawful immigrant who filed the application either money or some other reward for participating in what is frankly a criminal conspiracy, a conspiracy that often goes undetected and unpunished. Well, Jerry's career path and mine diverged. 1975, I became what used to be a criminal investigator, special agent. I rotated through all the divisions within the investigations branch. I even spent a number of years in the frauds unit where I investigated those suspected marriage frauds out in the street and worked closely with the adjudications officers who back then carried the title of immigration examiner. Jerry remained within that examinations program, the adjudications program, for the balance of his career, recently retired, where he was working at immigration headquarters, USCIS, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services in Washington, where he continued to work on the adjudications process. So with that for an introduction, Jerry Gasalli, I thank you so much for joining me on the program. Happy Friday to you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for inviting me to have a word. I'll leave it to you to pose any of many questions about this vast subject that you may want to focus the people's attention on.
Well, I'll give you more than a word, I promise you, although I do know I can sometimes go off. I think I got your career down pretty accurately, didn't I?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Actually, I started in on the marriage fraud project, having gotten restless with the original work as an inspector at Kennedy Airport back in 71. By the following year, I was on this pilot marriage fraud project, which ironically points out part of the history of the problems that we've had to deal with throughout the rest of our careers at the old INS. This project started by people noticing that if you just adjudicated or made decisions basically on visa petitions for relatives on paper only, they always looked more or less plausible because all you had was a few documents. And
when you say paper only, you mean without face-to-face interviews.
That's right. Yeah. If you remember, we were given those to do as standby work at the airport when we weren't inspecting flights.
Yeah, let me give my listeners a little bit of background for that. And I know that there's probably going to be a couple of folks listening today who probably are on Capitol Hill because Senator Sessions, in fact, just had a news conference yesterday. I had the opportunity to speak to one of his staffers, really terrific talking to her earlier today, about the fact that the whole process that Mr. Obama is calling prosecutorial discretion, I call prosecutorial deception, will really have no integrity to it. But as inspectors, our job at the airport was not to go through the baggage the way customs did looking for contraband, but to go through baggage and question the passengers as to what their intentions were. And that's something most people don't realize. Think of how daunting it is. When you watch CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, that's really a lesson in history. Something has already taken place, and now they're trying to put the pieces together to figure who did it and what the motivation might be. As an inspector sitting in a booth at an airport or a port of entry, your job in about a minute or so, if you remember, that was Lucy at the Bonbon Factory, we had to determine whether or not an alien, a non-citizen arriving in the United States, was actually only coming for a temporary visit if they were here with non-immigrant visas, if they weren't coming to work, and so forth. So we would ask about how much money they had, if they had a return ticket, what kind of work they did back home. And on occasion, we'd send them to secondary, where we could do a more detailed examination, maybe go through luggage, see if the guy that says he's coming for 2 weeks in August has his winter clothing with him, for example, which might indicate that he's thinking about staying a little bit more than 2 weeks in August. So that was what we did, you and I, before we became adjudicators. But when there were no flights coming in, rather than just have us sit around, to make good use of our time, we would adjudicate all sorts of applications, applications for lost alien cards, applications for reentry permits, and petitions for various immigration benefits, including, of course, the so-called marriage petitions in that unit that you're describing. So I just wanted to give you folks out there some idea about what we're talking about, because one of the problems those of us who work for the government have is we know what we're talking about. I just want to make sure that the listeners out there also know what we're talking about, Jerry.
Yes. Well, there came a time shortly after our careers began that downtown at the New York District Office, some enterprising supervisory, you know, examinations chief, convinced the regional people, and probably headquarters as well, that they should let him do a pilot project to take some of these spouse petitions and actually call in the people who were involved in the petition, both the citizen or permanent resident petitioner and the alien who was supposed to receive the benefit as the spouse. And to nobody's surprise who had been watching this, there was an enormous amount of, you know, fraud, deception, and bogus arrangements detected once we actually called these people in, as Mike's described. One of the other key things to really clinching the facts of the case was another feature of that project, which was an arrangement for cooperation between the examiner who was talking to these people and figuring out whether he had a good marriage or people who were engaged in fraud, to really determine the facts of the case sometimes.
Wait,
we could call in an investigator.
Yep.
Who was,
you know, what was
dedicated.
If you remember, Jerry, if people were kind of not all the brightest in the world, which sometimes happened, no matter how much you could confront them with the contradictory evidence, and in the beginning, they had no idea there was going to be an interview. They have a very good grapevine out there. So they'd come in and they'd say to the wife, "Where do you live?" And she'd give me an address. And they'd say to the husband, "Where do you live?" But, you know, of course, you would question one completely and then the other. But it would be kind of funny when the woman would say, "Well, I live at 123 Main Street," and she would describe a basement apartment in a private house, and the husband said that he lived on the seventh floor of an elevator apartment building. And every once in a while, you would actually have a couple that would say, "Well, I know our answers don't match, but we're really living together." And if they wouldn't admit to it and withdraw the petition, then, which was their option, the petitioner's option, the citizen's option, then we would call in the investigators, and they would go out on the street, and I did both sides of that equation, knock on the door, speak to the neighbors, see who's living there at, you know, 7:30 in the morning. You'd be there to see if they were there and so forth. But if you remember, in short order, what happened? They got their stories better organized. So we had it was the game of spy versus spy. So the more they knew we were going to do this, the more they would rehearse and practice. I used to ask for keys. So it got to the point, I remember saying to somebody, "My name is Mike Cutler, I'm an immigration inspector," and people would be reaching into their pockets and pocketbooks and dumping keys on the desk, knowing that I was the guy that would ask to see keys. So they're very crafty very often, because so much is at stake. And it really helped me to hone my skills as an interrogator, as a questioner, by doing, on average, maybe 8 of these a day, over in the office. And I guess that was pretty much what they were hoping for, anywhere from 6 to 8 interviews per day.
Yes.
But yes, here's my question, Jerry. That program worked. We saw the number of fraud cases drop because people knew they were going to get caught. The aliens in the case would find themselves being taken into custody, and we would seek to deport them from the United States. It was rare to prosecute the U.S. citizen, although in some cases we found citizens who might have been out on parole, they had convictions for serious crimes, and they were looking to make a quick buck by marrying an alien to give them the green card, but now they were facing having parole violations slapped on them. But for the most part, the citizens weren't punished, the aliens were.
Yes.
But once they stopped doing what we did, it was a zero-sum loss for the aliens. Nobody would look for them. Nobody would arrest them. Nothing would happen to them if they didn't get the green card, but mostly I think the fraud rate went back through the ceiling. Am I wrong on that one?
Well, that and one of the other reasons it did, of course, was the people who don't like immigration enforcement eventually mobilized to put the kibosh on the freedom to find out these facts and to do anything
remarkable.
About it.
You see, everyone talks about how we were a nation of law and a nation of immigrants. Now, imagine the first lesson. Because the first set of laws that aliens entering our country or who are already in our country generally encounter are the immigration laws. So you had these various advocacy groups, beginning with the American Immigration Lawyers Association and others, who did whatever they could to stymie any efforts to enforce the laws that at their foundation have just two mm-hmm. goals, protect American lives and protect American jobs. Isn't that astonishing?
Yes. So all sorts of devices were eventually invented to reverse the progress that this project, you know, had pioneered. So that, for example, eventually there was a hue and cry about how discriminatory it must mean for the, you know, the dark-minded examiner to collude with a dark-minded investigative officer to nail these poor people, and you know that was just a reproachable situation to allow them to combine their efforts to get at the bottom of this. So eventually, particularly in New York, there was actually administrative decisions to say we can no longer directly communicate and cooperate between the examinations and investigative branches to get at the bottom of this stuff. There were buffers and barriers and referrals and everything, and so that's one way that it, you know, went south.
Well, and look who's benefiting by this massive influx of alien workers: corporations, the immigration mm-hmm. lawyers who had a limitless flow of clients coming into their offices.
Yep.
They didn't want anything done to discourage people from filing applications because, after all, it was an easy buck for them. I remember there was this one attorney sitting at the desk with me, because they would be there while we did the interview, and it was just kind of funny. But I'm asking the person for his keys, and he hands me his keys, and because I wanted to see if they're living together. Obviously, if they lived together, they would have the same house key. And I used to actually make photostats of the keys. And I said to the guy, "How did you get here today?" And he said, "Well, I drove." And I said, "Where did you park?" He said, "Across the street from the office." And I knew, if you remember, Jerry, at the old 20 West Broadway where the office was, there was a parking lot where you would park your car, lock the door, they'd give you a ticket to pay afterwards, and you'd go where you had to go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I noticed there was no car key. So I said to the guy, "Where's your car keys?" Well, he whipped out another set of keys with another house key on it, and I said, "What's this?" And the lawyer was actually taking a nap next to me. He was sitting there with the newspaper spread out on his lap. He was starting out to do a crossword puzzle. He must have been in his late 70s, this particular attorney. And when he realized something was amiss, he looked up and said, "What just happened?" And I said, "Well, your client just handed me two different sets of house keys." And his newspaper fell on the floor. And the guy got all flustered, had a conversation with the U.S. citizen in this case, and they withdrew the application. But here was a lawyer who was being paid thousands of dollars for simply sitting there. And, in fact, at that moment said to the alien, "Well, now that you've done this, I get to charge you more money." And I almost fell out of my chair that here is a lawyer saying to his client as he was napping there and suddenly was awakened, "Now I'm going to charge you more because you committed fraud." It's astonishing to me that we always got painted as being the bad guys when in reality it was the attorneys. Do you remember the incident? We're taking a trip down memory lane here.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of lawyers who, after the interview, would come up to you and talk to you about last night's baseball game or anything.
Yes, I know where you're going with this. I know where you're going with this.
You remember. And
that turned out to be billable hours,
too. Do you want to tell the other half of the story, Jerry?
Yes. More billing. Yeah. That was consultation with the immigration officers involved in the case, which, of course, justified another big hit on the bill.
Yes, or there was actually a couple who we found out were telling the clients that they just bribed somebody and they want to be reimbursed the $2,000 or whatever that they alleged to have given the inspector at the time.
I remember another attorney who was one of the leading private immigration attorneys in Boston, where I later worked, who I noticed got into a habit of allowing his clients to not file for a waiver of certain kinds of violations that were relatively modest, he would wait and let them go into a denial mode, and eventually, if they were placed in removal proceedings, then he would rescue them at the last minute for a much larger fee, of course.
It was rip-off after rip-off after rip-off. But meanwhile, it was always the immigration officers, whether it was the inspectors at the airport, the adjudications officers, the investigators. Yeah. We were always getting the bum rap. And all we were trying to do was our job, which, again, when you come back to it, folks, was about protecting the lives and the job and the jobs of American citizens. In fact, the Labor Department used to run the Immigration Service prior to the Second World War.
Yes.
And you know, we had all kinds of crazy stuff happening. We had hookers coming in, pretending to be the spouse of some illegal alien. You name it, we had it.
Yes.
Now, let's go forward a little bit in time. In 1993, we had a terrorist attack. And this is about a political asylum case. And, you know, I happen to be Jewish. My grandmother died in the Holocaust. I was named after my grandmother. So I'm sensitive to this issue about political asylum. But there was a guy by the name of Amiel Kanzi, a Pakistani national, who was granted political asylum, even though, as it turned out, he lied through his teeth on his application. He got political asylum, and on a cold, bright morning in January of 1993, he stood outside CIA headquarters with an AK-47, opened fire, killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, fled the country, which is one of the advantages that foreign criminals and terrorists have. They have an escape hatch. This guy went back to Pakistan, but because of the nature of the crime, our guys hunted him down like the dog that he was, brought him back, put him on trial, found him guilty. He was ultimately executed for his crimes, but the people he killed remained dead or injured, those that were shot. Just 1 month later, we have the first attack at the World Trade Center. And again, immigration fraud figured prominently. They had gotten agricultural fraud, a la the 86 amnesty under President Reagan. In one case, we had Mahmoud Abu Alima said he worked at a bean farm in Florida. In point of fact, the only thing he ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the World Trade Center. So we knew that immigration fraud was impacting national security. I did my first hearing in 97 about immigration fraud. And you were there trying to weed out the fraud. And how much were you given in the way of tools after 93? Did anything change?
Actually, things tended to keep unraveling, although, of course, many speeches were made by our leaders, our political
How do you mean by unraveling? Why don't you explain that?
Well, there continued to be a series of little laws and nibbling things taking away the effect of the original requirements of the immigration laws, so that different people would be given waivers for this and that.
What's a waiver? Explain a waiver for the uninitiated.
Well, for example, one of the waivers is if you've been involved in visa fraud in order to come to this country, and basically you lied to the American consul or to the immigration inspectors when you were coming in, that constitutes a violation of one of the parts of the immigration laws.
And it's a criminal violation as well.
Yes, if the criminal penalty is invoked, which, interestingly enough, almost never is.
It's a five-year felony. That's my point.
Right. That's right. But,
although now it's a 10-year felony after 9/11. It became a 10-year felony. So keep going. I'm listening to you.
Yes. But these things were gradually enlarged upon by administrative memoranda and other kinds of regulatory things so that you could drive a bar. It was just an enormous hole in the administration of the things. And then the consequence when certain sections of the immigration laws are not enforced often is the administrative tendency of the leadership is to say, well, since so many are escaping this particular requirement, why bother with it at all?
There you go.
Let's pass on and not even get into those questions.
So instead of saying, this is where we're getting hammered, let's reinforce it, they say, well, we can anticipate this is what they're going to do, so why bother?
I
mean, isn't that crazy? Most people, if God forbid they suffer a burglary, go around the house and say, wow, they came in through the skylight. we should put a lock on the skylight. Immigration would have said, let's remove the skylight and just leave an open hole there.
Yeah. And for example, another feature of the Immigration and Nationality Act from its earliest form was, if you had a doubtful case of a person who looked like he might well not live up to the terms of his visa to come here, a bond could be placed on him that he would indeed, you know, do what he was supposed to do and then leave.
A maintenance of status bond, as we used to call it.
Maintenance of status and departure, right.
Right.
Well, over time, again, that was considered to be too much of a bother to invoke it, too much of a bother to take the fee, too much of a bother to give it back or consider, worst of all, to consider whether they had actually lived up to the terms of the bond. So basically that became a dead letter.
Let me ask you another question. Do you remember Citizenship USA?
Yes.
How did that affect your job? And do you want to explain what Citizenship USA basically was?
Well, it was essentially a project to streamline, that is, goose up the citizenship process during a time when a presidential election was in the offing.
1996, correct?
Yes. And so the idea was that it was very important that all aliens who were in the pipeline for citizenship should become citizens faster than normal so that they could participate in the upcoming presidential election. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination whether the administration had any ulterior motives as to which way they would vote if they got this benefit. But the fact is, it was done. And it was done with such a rapid shove-them-all-through attitude on the part of the leadership, who, of course, were given their marching orders by the administration.
The Clinton administration.
A number of criminals were shoved through the system and naturalized before their background checks had even been completed.
And the GAO reported on this. Now, here's something that's interesting.
Oh.
Let's look at the time frame. 1993, we suffer not one but two terrorist attacks where people are killed inside the United States by aliens who committed immigration fraud as an apparent embedding tactic, to use the jargon of the 9/11 Commission. So here it is, the burglary has been done. We see that they forced the back door open. So rather than say, we need to reinforce the back door, they said, let's leave the back door open.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair analogy?
Yes. By the way, I guess I'm not giving away too much to say there are a number of interesting footnotes to that episode. One was a congressional investigation group went down, for example, to the Miami district of the INS in those days to find out, whether they were really doing their job properly with screening these people. And they were given a number of claims about what was going on. In fact, they wanted to make sure that they weren't releasing these people into the public without keeping them in detention. In fact, they had been doing just that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that hit the fan. Supposedly, originally, they were crying for firing of the officials concerned, including the district director of Miami. Instead, the director of Miami, he was removed, but he was not removed from his salary. He was simply transferred to headquarters, kept, in a basement with the investigative people for a while. And after a couple of years go by, he emerged as the agency's chief security officer.
It reminds me of that movie with Dustin Hoffman. Do you remember it, Marathon Man? Is it safe?
Oh, yeah.
Not hardly. And so look at what happens, okay? In fact, I did my first hearing, congressional hearing, in May of 1997. It was either May 19th or May 20th. And what was the topic? Immigration fraud and visa fraud. Why did they convene the hearing? Because of those two terrorist attacks that had taken place more than 4 years earlier. Now, I don't blame the people. I'm happy they held a hearing. In fact, Lamar Smith and at the time Henry Hyde was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the late Henry Hyde. They're the ones who issued my letter of invite, and Doris Meisner, the then commissioner of the INS, literally had a cow over it. They tried to keep me from testifying, but ultimately, you know, I did go testify. But what was so remarkable was the time frame. And it wasn't, and I'm a Democrat, by the way. This is a nonpartisan issue, immigration. This is about America and American lives and our security as a country. But what was incredible was we won the Second World War in just 44 months, and it took around, I don't know, 55 or 60 months or whatever it was before they could actually hold a hearing to figure out how the terrorists were able to enter our country, hide in plain sight, and then attack the CIA and attack the World Trade Center. We are moving glacially. And, of course, what happens next are the attacks of 9/11. And lo and behold, what do we find about those 19 terrorists? They had all gamed the visa process, or they gamed the immigration benefits program, or they were able to avoid being arrested by immigration even when police found them here as overstays. Nothing happened to them. Now, if any of those things had not happened, if they had been prevented from getting visas, if they had been prevented from entering the United States, if they had been stopped by the police and turned over to immigration, the plot would have been averted. It would have been thwarted. So look at all of this chain of screw-ups, and here's the remarkable part. Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, just a couple of weeks after 9/11, tries to blow up an airplane by hiding bombs in his shoes, gets on an airplane, headed for the United States from England. He's the reason we take our shoes off. Yet Reid didn't need a visa to get on board that airplane or to enter the United States. And today we've gone from the 27 visa waiver countries that were, you know, on that list when he tried the attack to 36 visa waiver countries. So every time we find a vulnerability, we not only ignore the vulnerability, but it seems as though we open the hole wider. Am I mistaken on this, Jerry?
I'm afraid you're very much right. In fact, during the same period, the agency that I belong to, which is one, the USCIS, is a benefits-granting agency. But, of course, the granting of benefits is supposed to be balanced by our responsibility to make sure that everybody we give, you know, grant the benefits to are qualified for them under law. But over the years, more and more, the leadership becomes enamored of these terminologies as if we were actually manufacturing hamburgers instead.
Yeah, hamburgers,
They're always talking about business processes. They're talking about, instead of applicants, even if they're alien, even if they're illegal aliens in some cases, no, they are customers. And, of course, what do you do with customers? You always have to satisfy a customer.
Well, you know, what's so funny was in 2005, I was called by the House Immigration Subcommittee because they were upset. And I got to tell you, this took a lot of chutzpah on the part of the members of Congress because, remember, George Bush was the president, George W., and the Congress was controlled by the Republicans. So we had some leaders who had some real starch. You had John Hostetler, who unfortunately is no longer there, but he was chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee. Lamar Smith was there. A number of these folks, Steve King was there, true leaders. And what they did was they held a hearing because they wanted to know why on earth the President of the United States would cut the money appropriated for hiring more personnel for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Border Patrol, because Congress had appropriated enough money to hire 800 new ICE agents and 2,000 new Border Patrol agents. The president said, we're going to make the 800 ICE agents, we're going to cut that down to 143, I still remember those numbers, and we're going to take the 2,000 Border Patrol agents, and we're going to whittle that down to 210. They asked me if I would testify. I said, wow, try to stop me. And as I prepared my testimony, I looked at what Mr. Eduardo Aguirre had to say. And I'm sure that name is familiar to you because he was the head of Citizenship and Immigration Services back in that time. And he said that his three priorities, and he made me think of this when you said that, priority number one was to clear up the backlog of applications. Now, hold the thought that my next question will go back to about clearing up the backlog. Priority number two was to improve customer service, which is how the word association hit me. Yeah. And finally, he said, enhance national security. So we have national security playing not second but third fiddle to clearing up the backlog, improving customer service, and then with whatever resources are left, then we'll take a peek at national security. So let's go to the issue of clearing up the backlog. That means you want to move the applications as quickly as possible. Would you not presume that, Jerry?
Yes, we are forcibly presumed.
Okay, so that is my question.
Yes.
What's the easiest way to increase your productivity? Is it to deny or approve applications? Does it matter?
You wield that approval stamp as quickly and as often as you can, because that gets the numbers up that satisfies an officer's standing as an officer in good standing, eligible for further promotions and bonuses.
And that was a critical element in your job description and your evaluation.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes,
so
in fact, sometimes knowledge of the law and detecting fraud is another element on the thing, but only the productivity of the numbers is what really counts in the end.
Okay, so now here's my next question. If you had to compare the amount of time it takes to deny versus approve, what are we looking at? How long would it take for you to approve an application?
I'm sure it depends. There are some sort of routine denials that are kind of...
Ignore denial. Yeah. Just if you were going to approve something, how long does it take to do an approval?
Well, the allotment for, say, an adjustment of status to permanent resident case is less than half an hour.
How fast could you do it if you were really a speed demon? If you wanted to get a speeding ticket, how fast could you do it?
Oh, yes, you could just breeze through it. You're supposed to put them under oath, of course, but you can. I've seen some people who were under pressure doing this. They said, this is true, right? That's true, right? They don't even
time-wise,
directly
what are we talking
ask.
About, Jerry? Jerry, what are we talking about? How quick? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? What are we talking about?
Yes, certainly
okay.
5 minutes. Will often do the whole thing if they're not really paying any attention to the content of the application. That's right.
Now here's my other question.
All you need to do is really get their signature at the end.
Okay. Now, if you wanted to deny it, how long would it take? Could it take?
Oh, that's usually, for example, you have to gather more information, more documentation from them in order
all
to
right,
make
just,
the denial
just for
valid.
The average listener who's listening. Without going through all the whole deal of I start my car by opening my door and adjusting my mirrors,
yes,
you're going
yes.
for a drive. How long would it take?
Well, in
hours?
My experience, it took at least 3 to 4 hours for a good
That's
denial.
That's what I'm looking for. And forgive me for doing it this way, because I just want people out there to get a clear picture.
Yes.
If you're going to deny an application, you're looking at a half a day maybe. If you're going to approve an application, it's 10 minutes. And if you're the ever-ready rabbit and you really want to get ahead, because after all, we all go to work at the end of the day, hopefully to do the right thing, but most importantly, we want to satisfy our bosses, so we make we make a good impression, get a good evaluation, become eligible for promotions and awards. There was a story about people getting gift cards to was it Target or Walmart? Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
How did you qualify for a gift card?
That story, I was not.
Okay, but you heard that story, didn't you?
Yes, from a distance. Yeah.
From a distance. Okay, what was the story you heard at a distance?
I'd rather go on to the fact.
All right, but here's my point.
I've had supervisors, mention, very very pointedly to their officers.
Okay.
Listen. They're going to get it anyway, if they have to go through an appeal. So why are we wasting our time denying it if in the end they're going to prevail with an attorney or something and
get
it?
Let me ask you a question. You know who Michelle Malkin is, don't you? You've seen her stuff. She's on TV. She had a wonderful quote, besides the times when she's quoted me. Michelle, if you're listening, thank you. But she said the game isn't over until the alien wins. How far off was she?
Well, not very far, it would seem, because I'm sure you can remember them, too. there have been immigration attorneys who've become so cocky that they'll actually go on the record to some reporter saying, you give me enough fees, and I'll ensure that this person never leaves the country, no matter what they've done.
And how many times did your bosses at the airport, when we were inspecting passengers, say to you, don't send the guy to secondary, limit him to 2 weeks, and say he only wants 2 minutes on the other side of the door so he has a running head start?
That's
Do you
right.
remember those days?
That's right. Just pass it down the line, kick the can down the road to some other theoretical backup that, of course, usually doesn't exist in our agency.
Right. The reserve,
but, you know,
the
that
reserve
was the theory.
Was a bag filled with dirty laundry, not another parachute.
Right. They would say, well, investigations or deportation people will eventually deal with them if we let them in and make
and
a
if
mistake.
And if we wait 50 years, the Undertaker will deal with them 50 or 60 years from now, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's really a pathetic situation, but it's nothing to laugh at. Because understand something, folks. Among the people who did this were the terrorists, were the criminals, were the bad guys who killed people. You know, there was a case when I was working up at the FBI. We had an alien who had naturalized, and this really blew my mind. He naturalized while he was out on bail pending sentencing because he had just pleaded guilty to a drug conviction. And you thought to yourself, well, maybe this is the first time. No, it turned out that he had been imprisoned a couple of times. And each time he pleaded guilty. So it's not even when they asked him on his exam, on the naturalization part, well, did you ever commit a crime? And he's saying, no, I didn't. I was falsely accused. That's one thing. But if you plead guilty, you're acknowledging that you did the crime. So here was a guy who at least three or four times had pleaded guilty, weapons possession, assault, drug possession, sale of narcotics. He's out on bail pending sentencing, and that's when we swear him in as a U.S. citizen, and he probably becomes a fugitive. Do you know I could not get the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, the assistant that I had a meeting with, to agree to indict this guy for naturalization fraud?
Yes. Well,
I mean, this is such an exercise in futility, and you would think that of all the laws on the books, the most reasonable are the laws that are trying to keep out those people who would be a threat to our safety or well-being, wouldn't you think?
Yes, you would, but it's a strange situation with agencies like ours that rarely are their spokesmen selected to speak for the value and the necessity of the laws that we were supposed to be administering. They're always apologizing that anybody actually gets on the wrong side of the requirements.
Astonishing. It's truly astonishing. And you know,
when was the last time you heard a commissioner or a director of ICE or USCIS get up and say, you know, it's important that we only give the benefits to the people that under law are supposed to have it, and we are dedicated to making sure that only the people who are qualified for the benefits are going to get
them. I can actually answer your question. That it was a gentleman by the name of Chapman who had been the Marine Commandant.
Yeah. It's been a little while, though, hasn't it, Mike?
Yes, well, Mr. Chapman was there back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And that's, if you wonder why we got to where we are today, Jerry, that's why. I used to say that, well, first of all, out of frustration, I used to call the Immigration and Naturalization Service the Imitation and Neutralization Service.
Yeah.
And I used to say that it was the agency that refused to take itself seriously. Yeah. And unfortunately, that was really where we went down the tubes. Because if the agency itself that has sole authority to enforce immigration laws doesn't want to do the job, then there's no other backup. Now, the Supreme Court decision that was just handed down in the Arizona case, SB 1070, and I worked with a law firm that had been retained by Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona, the Supreme Court basically said, no, we're not going to let the states enforce immigration laws. I mean, it was a big deal that they allowed police to ask to see someone's ID.
Right.
And, you know, what was astonishing was the way the news covered it. There was a reporter on a major network who was strutting around the stage, I kid you not, saying, papers, please, doing a Nazi impersonation. And I really took umbrage at that, having been an immigration officer for 30 years and having lost a good part of my family to the Holocaust.
Yep.
And it was as though this was now a new requirement. And they interviewed people on the local radio station, who it was very interesting who they picked, people with very strange-sounding last names, but who spoke flawless English, who said, well, my gosh, now I'm going to have to carry some kind of documentation with me or I'm liable to get arrested. Well, you and I both know, Jerry, that the Alien Registration Act of 1940 is where we first had the mandate that any alien 18 years of age or older has to carry proof of alien registration, which means the green card or
so
whatever.
You think 80 years would be enough to sink in that there is a requirement for this?
You would think, and meanwhile, we have these reporters jumping up and down saying, oh, my God, now they're going to have to carry their green cards. No, they've been supposed to carrying them for 80 years. So what has really happened is a public relations campaign that is unprecedented in any other area of law enforcement that I've ever been aware of. Isn't it astonishing?
Well, yes, it is, and it's another thing that's the relentlessness of the campaign to simply repeat things that aren't true, but you know, by repetition, they gradually lull people into thinking that you know that what isn't is.
When did you retire, Jerry?
About 2 years plus change, yes, in January of 2010.
I should have sent you a recording of Martin Luther King saying, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last.
I do look around me, of course, and then I live in Maryland, so of course I can't ever forget too much, you know, what's going on, because...
You're near Washington.
Yes.
Yeah, you're near the heat source, which of course is headquarters, and you get to see the newspapers on a daily basis of how we've politicized everything, even common sense. So, how bad has it gotten? What is morale like over at Citizenship and Immigration Services with this onslaught that just never seems to let up?
Well, it's pretty much the pattern of, you know, young officers coming in thinking they're really going to master this body of law and really do some important work, which of course by law they have to, and gradually becoming burnt out, you know, just on these treadmills.
What was the attrition rate?
Looking for some other, you know, trade.
Get me, feet don't fail me now. What was the attrition rate of these guys who became disillusioned and thought they'd landed in hell?
Oh, gosh. You know, that's interesting. For my own morale, I never really compiled them. I would have been one of them, you know, some years ago, maybe myself, but
I guess I come from a stubborn background
or something. But
we used to joke about the fact that the old-timers, those of us who had given up and decided to stay in for the duration, they'd say, you guys never seem to have the names of these young kids, you know, at your fingertips. And they said, why bother? They're not going to stay that long.
Well, you know, when we were in our early 20s and starting out in this business, and I arrived downtown at the old headquarters of the district office in New York, I saw some old-timers gathered there who'd been around for a lot more years than I, who would, I noticed in their spare time, endlessly talk about computing their retirement benefits and whether they had enough to leave. And being, you know, a person who knew it all, you know, and was going to really leave my mark, I was thinking, what is the matter with these people? How can they have so little spirit and self-esteem?
And those were the good old days, as we would now say, huh?
I used to say
that the INS, the old agency, was in a state of free fall. And in the beginning, I said, bottom is elusive. After a few years and I realized what was going on, I said, no, it's not elusive, it's illusory. There is no bottom. And today we see why I came to that conclusion, because as bad as you think it might be today, there's always tomorrow.
Yes, but I would say one thing. I mean, as bad as working conditions have become for adjudicators of, you know, visa benefits and, of course, investigators as well, I'm sure.
The special agent.
It's amazing how just the fact that people somehow at bottom, once they become familiar with what they're doing, when they have all these responsibilities and they realize what the laws were designed to do, whether they get to carry them out or not, these people, even today, as beaten up as they are, could really start doing an outstanding job for the country if they were allowed, you know, and given them the resources to carry out their work.
Isn't that remarkable?
As beaten down as they are, there's just this idea, I want to do something that matters.
Well, you know, if anybody from the Mitt Romney campaign happens to be listening tonight, mm-hmm. I've given up on saying I wish the president would listen, because I know he's not listening. When he could stand there and talk about prosecutorial discretion, and I called it for the Fox News Latino website prosecutorial deception. And by the way, Jerry and all you folks out there, I just wrote another op-ed for Fox News Latino. My understanding is it will be posted tomorrow on their website. I will have it up on my website. And let me talk a little bit about those websites again. I didn't really mention it all that much tonight, and I do like to try to squeeze it in at least a couple times. Again, please go to capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. That's a terrific website for Californians for population stabilization. I do a lot of writing for them. I have a couple of articles that are in the queue, as they say, that will be up there. TalkBorder.com, I've got a bunch of interviews up there, videos, hopefully a couple more to follow this weekend, and some commentaries, and I will try to get this thing posted, and also at MichaelCutler.net. But, you know, if you look at what is going on with the desire to do a good job, if the Romney team would only wake up and look at the impact that the failures to secure our borders and enforce our immigration laws are having, with all the talk about outsourcing jobs, with all the talk about creating jobs, you know, I was given the privilege of addressing the Tea Party convention in South Carolina a few months ago. Newt Gingrich was there. Mr. Santorum was there. And I spoke right after Gingrich. I, of course, jokingly told people afterwards that he was my warm-up act. Not quite, but I couldn't resist. But I bumped into him at the bar that night, and I asked him, why on earth, with all this talk about the need to create jobs, don't you talk about the need to liberate jobs? It takes time and money to create a job. You have to build a facility, which means you need to get the money, which means you need to get something constructed. It's time-consuming. But if you want to get a lot of Americans back to work tomorrow morning, all you have to do is enforce the immigration laws. And as the illegal workforce goes out the back door, the very same day, you could be bringing in the legal workforce through the front door. And if there are, and they're saying 11 million, we've been hearing 11 million forever, I'm willing to bet there are 30, 35 million, God only knows at this point, illegal aliens in our country. But you probably have 11 million working. The others may be dependents or whatever. Well, imagine if a sizable chunk of 11 million illegally working aliens were removed or convinced they need to leave, you would be freeing up 11 million jobs overnight. And this nonsense about how they do the work Americans won't do is an insult to every hard-working American citizen and lawful immigrant. We see it in the construction trades. My dad was a plumber. And if you look at those construction workers, folks, you drive by those road gangs and the people putting up buildings. They're out there in 100-degree weather, sweating into their socks, busting their tails, doing their jobs. Construction work is more dangerous than law enforcement. It is filthy. It is backbreaking. And the Americans are out there day after day doing those tough jobs, Americans of every race, every religion, every creed, every you name it. So this nonsense about the work Americans won't do, you pay an American a living wage, which is what this is about, and that American will do a good day's work and help to get America moving again. Bringing in foreign workers undermines the American worker. It undermines the American economy. So if there's going to be all this debate about who's going to create more jobs or who outsourced more jobs, Mr. Romney, if you're listening, if your people are listening, why on earth are you not going after the failures of this administration in particular to enforce immigration laws and, in fact, going in the opposite direction, providing employment authorization to millions of aliens who won't even have to prove that? If you look at the Sessions press conference, I sent you the link to it, Jerry, how disheartening was it to hear from the president of the union that represents ICE saying that the adjudicators are being told, you won't even need to ask for documents. take what they say on their applications at face value and adjudicate the application. This is an invitation for fraud, and not only fraud
yes.
for people to get employment, but fraud for people to change their identity. So if their true names are on the terror watch list or no-fly lists, they will easily sidestep the process now, because without anything, they just have to lie about who they are. And, you know, I have a funny feeling terrorists might be willing to lie and criminals might be willing to. Am I crazy? Or might they lie, Jerry? What do you think?
I just couldn't hazard a guess, Mike. But I will say that all this reminds me, strangely enough, of the one-time-only amnesty of the Act of 1986, doesn't it? Where they were saying, just
yep.
take whatever they say, don't bother with looking into it. In fact, we don't even want you people to go outside the little pile of papers that these people submit to you saying that they were there for the requisite amount of time to qualify for the amnesty, or in the case of agricultural workers, that they actually did the work. Don't bother with all that stuff.
And
in
do you
fact,
remember the
if
red,
you try
red
to, you might be in trouble. You, the adjudicator, might be.
Do you remember the red sheets that were on those amnesty applications that you
yeah.
couldn't? Anything that
yeah.
was under the red sheet could not be shared with any other law enforcement agency?
Yeah, and of course, these people, just like the new batch of people, we don't even really know who they are.
Right. So how do you know Mike Cutler is Mike Cutler if I
yeah.
just handed a piece of paper and say, my name is Joe Smith, because you know,
yep.
that's who I want to be today.
Yep.
Now, there's another problem that I've talked about in the past, and I know you know about this.
Mm-hmm.
An alien who naturalizes gets to take any name he or she wants to take. Their U.S.
Yep.
passport only reflects their new name.
Yep. That's one of the things they're entitled to ask for. Of course, they're not supposed to do it for unlawful purposes, but how do you know?
Well, and,
what
and
the
of course,
is?
Again, terrorists and criminals would never lie about any such thing. So
right.
I got a call from an inspector at a major port of entry a number of years ago, and I confronted Mike Chertoff with this when we both spoke at Chapman Law School.
Hmm.
And this inspector told me he hadn't had a good night's sleep in about a month. What was the problem? Well, the problem was that he had a guy come into his booth with a U.S. passport that said he was born in Beirut, Lebanon. He had an Anglo-sounding name, but he didn't look or sound Anglo. He had a super heavy Arabic accent. He was very
mm-hmm.
concerned, and so he played a hunch and said to the guy, what was your name before you naturalized? And he told him, and it was an Arabic
yep.
name. He ran that name. It turned out that this guy was on the list as an international terrorist for whom a warrant had been issued, which, of course, raises the issue about how we naturalize somebody. When did they find out he was a terrorist? It could be that he was determined to be a terrorist after he naturalized. He had naturalized
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 years earlier, God knows. But the problem was that because the passport only reflected his new name, when he looked at all the inspection stamps, the admission and exit stamps in the passport, this character had traveled all over Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East, on which was, for all intents and purposes, an assumed identity that our government provided him with. But meanwhile, the TSA is strip-searching 85-year-old women and 4-year-old little girls who hug their grandmas before they get on an airplane. The theater
yep.
of national security.
Which is another thing that is increasingly problematic to the administering the immigration laws as they were originally intended to be administered, is that people within the Congress from time to time tack on various provisions that whittle away at these requirements and these safeguards so that the immigration law as it's now administered resembles more a big piece of Swiss cheese, you know, than any kind of solid policy, because they're undermining on all parts. For example, under the name of making sure that, say, naturalization applications for citizenship are processed quickly enough, there was actually a legal requirement put in saying, well, if there's not a decision within 120 days of filing, the person can insist on being naturalized by, you know, a judicial process.
Wow. I didn't
and, of
know
course,
that, one.
That
this
means
is a new one for me.
Right. So that, of course, means if you've got all kinds of inquiries out as to whether this person's legit or all kinds of other really hairy issues, you're trying to get police records or something to look into that person's background. It's very easy from the start of the application that you don't even start working on it usually until a couple of months have gone by. So the adjudicator is under the gun to do something without really having enough information in many cases to make a real informed decision. But that's one of the things that was put in by members of Congress.
Well, here's what
usually is part of a larger bill that nobody else in the Congress is paying much attention to when they vote it up.
Well, here's the issue, folks. If you have a member of Congress in your district, because I think that's really where the action's going to be,
mm-hmm.
You know, when Mr. Obama said that he was going to basically enact the provisions of the DREAM Act by fiat, by executive order, I mean, this is insanity. This is a violation of our Constitution and checks and balances, it would certainly appear.
Yep.
So the heck with Congress. Congress failed to act. Remember that statement? Congress
yeah.
did act. That's baloney. I testified before three House
yep.
and one Senate hearing, and Congress looked at the facts and said, no, this is bad law. We're not going to pass it. So Congress,
yep.
it's not that it failed to act. It didn't act the way
they rejected
the president
it.
Wanted.
Yeah. yeah.
They said no. That's not the same as voting present, as someone else we all know used to do. So they did act. And they acted to say no. And he said, the hell with your no. I'm going to trump your no with an executive order.
Yes.
We don't need no stinking due process.
Go
we don't need no stinking
it.
Checks and balances because I have executive orders. And
yes.
that's what this is, and that's what is so dangerous, folks, because if
yep.
the will of the people is expressed through the voice of the Congress, and the
mm-hmm.
Congress can have an end run done around it the way this president has done. And he's not the only one. You know, the privacy laws, and you know as well as I, supposedly only covered American citizens and lawful immigrants. So if you were
yeah.
here as a businessman or a student or whatever, or a tourist, but and you were here legally. But if, you know, something came up, you were not supposed to be protected by the privacy laws. That was reserved for U.S. citizens and resident aliens. Mike Chertoff and the George W. Bush administration said, oh, no. We're going to cover everybody by the Privacy Act, by executive
yeah.
order. So increasingly, we have seen the way that we've had a succession of presidents ignore the Constitution, ignore the will of the people, and ignore the process by which we legislate through fiat. Why bother? We don't need those stinking laws. We have executive action. And that's what we've really got to be mindful of. But we've got to get Congress on our side. The real battle today, folks, is going to be in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And that's
yeah.
why we need to be involved. You need to develop a relationship with your congressmen and with your senators. They need to know who you are. They need to hear from you. And you need to make them accountable. And this isn't about advocating one party over the other. Don't vote a party line. Don't vote a party line. This nonsense about declare independence, well, that's fine, only if you live in a state where by becoming an independent, you don't lose your vote in the primary. You don't want to give up your vote in the primary because all too often we wind up voting not for the best candidate but for the lesser of two evils. And sometimes it's really difficult to figure out who's worse. You know, when I was asked about who I wanted to see win a particular election, I said, that's like being asked if you want cancer or a heart attack. And the solution there is to be involved in the primary process so that hopefully you can weed out the clunkers. But really, that's why I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport. You know, I got to tell you, Jerry, the time flew. We're actually into a little bit of overtime here, which fortunately we can do. But, you know, your insight is amazing. You and I had the privilege of working together, and it was a pleasure to work with you.
Well, thank you. Yes, all these years, you do accumulate a few ideas, all right.
You think. Well, we had a front row seat to a train wreck is how I kind of describe it.
Indeed, more than one. But
more than one. But, you know, it's wonderful. It was a joy to have you on. I hope to get you back again to talk about some of these issues. I hope you enjoyed it and it wasn't too painful for you.
Well, thank you. Yes, it was a first-time effort in terms of radio presence.
And I also dragged you, if you remembered, before the state legislative hearing in Maryland the last time I saw you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're scoring all kinds of firsts around.
I've got to be careful about meeting up with you, Mike.
I'm going to get you into a world of trouble, I promise you, Jerry. Why should I be the only troublemaker?
That's right.
Oh, my God. Jerry Casale, I thank you for joining me on the program. You know, folks, this is really what I'm focused on doing. I am so frustrated that most of the major news outlets, so-called, have forgotten what their obligation as journalists is. They don't understand that obligation, or they don't want to. The bottom line is that most of us have no idea what is going on in the world, because it's rare to be standing in a place where a major news story is happening, and hopefully we don't want to be near too many of those breaking news events. So we depend on the media. We depend on newspapers and radio and television and magazine writers to tell us what's going on. But if they don't tell us what's going on, it's not that whether the tree falls in the forest if it makes a sound, it's whether anyone even knows that the tree fell. And unfortunately, it's increasingly difficult to know when a tree falls in the forest, because too many journalists are acting as censors. Too many news organizations are concerned about corporate profit more than they are about living up to what should be their code of ethics and morality, and that's to report the news objectively and fairly. So with this program, with my website at michaelcutler.net, with what I write for capsweb.org, and what I do on talkborder.com, my goal is to provide you with the news, with the information that you're probably not going to get anywhere else. If you like the program, please tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell people that disagree with you. I one time was at the Lou Dobbs Tonight after we had done an interview with Bill Tucker, and Lou sat down and had a talk with me and my wife and my youngest son, who at the time was about to turn 9, or actually it was his 9th birthday. We were in the city that day, it was a number of years ago, and he and I had this conversation, and I said, you know, the one thing that I've learned is that even though I'm a Jewish kid, I know you can't do missionary work unless you leave the confines of the church. So the important thing is not to not have conversations with your neighbors who disagree with you. When we are growing up, we're told, don't talk about religion and don't talk about politics when you go to a party because it's too contentious. Well, on the religion issue, I agree. A person's relationship with God, whether he has one or not, whatever it is, that's about as private and personal as it can get. But folks, we need to engage our neighbors and our friends in a polite discussion, you know, peaceably assemble about the issues that are important to us. Because in that vacuum of a lack of knowledge, too many people really don't know what's going on. And that's the danger to censorship. That's why you look at dictatorships and you realize one of the first things they do is to clamp down on the news, to keep people as ignorant as possible. And my goal is to make certain that we celebrate the First Amendment so that we can all be the best citizens that we could possibly be. And that's why I always like to make the point that democracy is not a spectator sport, but if you want to be a participant, then you better know what's going on. And I hope that at least where the issues of immigration and border security and related areas are concerned, that this is where you go to get the information that you're probably not going to get anywhere else. Jerry, you want the last word? It's yours.
No, except to thank you for, you know, all these. It's been a few years now you've been doing this, and it's
only
wonderful
10,
that there are
actually
still people who care enough to get out there and say what needs to be said, because if people don't, then the reality, as far as the rest of our neighbors are concerned, will be the people who are saying things that aren't true.
Excellent.
Just by repetition, it becomes the truth to them if they never hear anybody to set the record straight. And you're one of the guys who make sure they can't they can't have the field without a little bit of correction.
Yeah, well, I try to run interference on behalf of the truth. Truth, yeah. Justice, and as Superman would say, the American way. So... Well, Jerry, I got to tell you, it was really fun having you on the program today. Folks, I'm going to wish
Michael.
All of you Yeah, thank you. I wish all of you a wonderful weekend out there. Hope where you are, the weather will be good. You'll have a good time. But please, folks, keep on top of the issues. Take your citizenship seriously. Indeed, democracy is not a spectator sport. Check out the Fox News Latino website, I believe, tomorrow morning. You'll see another one of my articles up there. And check out my other website, talkborder.com. Go to capsweb.org. And I hope to see you next week, same place, same time, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Have a great weekend, everybody. Until next time, so long.